Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Very pleased with where we stand as a football team tonight, and we're excited to see these guys once they hit the field in May.
Adding a number of young, talented players that will be the foundation of what we're trying to build here, not only individually but collectively as a group. Even just having the guys from the first three rounds in has been special. You know, there's been an energy to it, headed in a positive direction after a long offseason, another difficult transition. You know, really a positive 3 days, the culmination of a lot of hard work, volume of talent, but specifically addressing a particular areas of the roster where we wanted to improve. Wide receiver, obvious, and pass rusher as well.
And we have one mission, is to help the football team and organization become the best it could be. I think it's truly a credit to our scouts and our coaches, just our process, because I think we try to do everything we can to get as much information as we can to make good decisions about the players that we put on our football team. I think we get that it's bigger than just football. It's also about people and doing things right and doing things the way we want to do them here in Cleveland. And I think we set out and we were able to accomplish that.
Really well-rounded group, put a lot of time and energy into all of these guys. Really felt at the end of the day when we finished picking that we improved the football team, improved the depth of the team, and improved the competition of the team. And that was our goal going into it. When we do the evaluation process, it's important to not only look at the player and what position they play in college, have they played a position previously, you know, in their sophomore year, their freshman year, and when you're projecting to the NFL, can they play a different position? Because we know we can only dress, you know, 46 players. So every roster spot that we bring to the game is vitally important. If a guy can play more than one spot, that adds to his value. Yeah, I mean, I think I've said it before. I think it's good football business to take a quarterback probably every other year.
Last year's was last year's situation. I don't think it has anything to do with this year. You know, we look forward, you know, to the matchup tonight, and you know, we've been hungry for a game. You know, obviously, we've been off for quite a while, but we've been hungry for a game, and we're happy that we're able to have it on our home floor.
Main objective tonight is to get off to a good start. I mean, I think after having 7 or 8 days off, you know, that's something that we want to come out and do naturally, but need to get a good warm up. Minds when they're in the right place, and we know that we're playing a good team, so that should get us up for tonight.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Welcome indeed back to the show, my friends, where, you know what, after a weekend like this, it really, really never does end. Welcome to ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo sports leader, and we have got a lot. Yes, indeed. You should applaud. You should cheer. You should be excited. Oh, this is one of those rare moments. Greeny said it best this morning. I don't know if you were listening at about 6 o'clock this morning, Jim, but Jim Kushlin is here as well, by the
What's
way.
What's going
Kush,
on?
How you doing?
I'm doing good.
I don't know if you're up at 6 a.m. to listen to all of Mike and Mike in the morning, but...
I was up soon after that. The little one makes sure of that.
There you go. Yeah, that'll do it. That'll do it. Anyway, Greeny was spot on when he, you know, this is one of those rare weekends when all four sports were in action. All four major professional sports, North American sports, were in action.
Yeah.
Because the NHL playoffs were played this weekend. The NBA playoffs were playing this weekend. Major League Baseball was playing this weekend. And the NFL was playing this weekend. I mean, you know, this is essentially about as close as you can be to having games as not having games when you have three straight days, beg your pardon, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, so that's why it counts for the weekend, of draft and the making or remaking of franchises far and wide. It was one of those outstanding weekends where you never were at a, you know, at a loss for something to watch. In fact, you're probably, you know, doing that channel surf thing, or not channel surf thing. Yeah, I got DirecTV, so you got like the last four channels watched. So you can just go bink, 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 and rotate between four channels all at once. And that's kind of how it was all weekend.
Yeah, pretty much for me, too, when I wasn't out calling balls and strikes and things this weekend. Yeah, it was. That's kind of the weekend it was, flipping around between pretty much everything, and not a dull moment on any of them, really.
No, not at all. Not at all. The Cleveland Browns apparently think they need 19 wide receivers in this coming football season on their 53-man roster, because I think they took like 17 or during the draft, particularly on day number 3 of the NFL draft. We'll talk about that. We will talk about the Lions draft a little bit today as well. All of that coming up at about 4:05 when Chris Lemieux will join us to break down the NFL draft. But that's just part of the story today. The Cavaliers back in NBA playoff action. You know, Jim, did you kind of forget about them a little bit over the course of the last week?
Towards the end of the week, especially when the draft talk took center stage, you tend to forget that they've been sitting idle all this time.
I mean, it's weird. I haven't had them on my mind for several days. You know, they swept the Pistons and have been sitting idle waiting for the next round, you know, to be ready to begin.
By the time they tip off tonight, it'll be an 8-day layoff.
There you go. And it's not like I'm ignorant of the NBA playoffs, because I was very interested to see that Game 7 yesterday between the Heat and the Hornets, which, of course, was a rout. The Raptors closing out the Pacers in another Game 7, that was really disappointing for me. I was kind of hoping Indiana would win that, just because of Paul George, I think. But it's okay. I mean, I'm not upset. I don't have a real rooting interest in either one of those franchises. But you had Game 7s going on. Game 1 on Friday between the Spurs, or was that Saturday?
That was Saturday.
Saturday. Between the Spurs and the Thunder, the epic rout that it was, the unbelievable shooting of the Spurs, 18 of 22 in the first quarter. 18 of 22. Did you hear me? That game was over by the time people got their, you know, seats warm. By the time they sat down and had their first drink, for crying out loud, or the first pass by the vendor, that game was over. So I'm watching NBA 82% playoffs.
82%, by the way, that comes out to.
What was it, 82?
80, well, 81.8, I'm rounding up.
I mean, holy cow. So it's not like I'm oblivious to the NBA playoffs. I'm watching games this weekend, and yet I was so, I don't know, into those games, or I don't know if I'd say into them, but I guess I was just so transfixed by what was in front of my eyes that my mind never really ventured to what's to come. I mean, I forgot about the Cavaliers. Not that I thought their season was over. It just was a non-factor, I guess. It was just a, I don't know, they'd been away for so long, and by the way, I mean off of my TV screen or my radio, that I just couldn't, I just didn't really focus. And then I realized, hey, you know, this is yesterday. I realized game one's tomorrow. Cavaliers and Hawks are ready to go tomorrow. So they're ready to go.
And at least we won't forget about them now, because every game in this series, except for game 7 next weekend, is all game, day off, game, day off. It's only one day between from here on in.
It's going to be nice and condensed.
You won't forget about them this time, that's for sure.
No, and that's good. I mean, because I got to tell you, those long droughts, you know, when one team sweeps and another team goes to 7 or you know, long series like that.
And in the East, two of them went to 7, and the one involving the Cavs, that would be the Hawks-Celtics winner, that ended up going 6. So they had to just wait around just to even find the opponent, let alone the scheduling. But, of course, the side effect, Bob, I think, of a long layoff like that is a lot of people going out on speculation lane in terms of, and the biggest theme I've discovered is trying to compare this semifinal and the layoff and everything else to last year's against the Bulls. And I keep thinking every time I read one, I must have read about 3 or 4 from all sorts of different various angles over the last couple days. That's how I reminded myself that there were still Cavs existing.
Right.
And I keep thinking, you guys are, this is what happens when you have a long layoff. You're reading too much into this. The only thing similar between this year and last year at this time was the length of a layoff. Everything else is completely different. Like, oh, I don't know, they were trying to adjust for Kevin Love not being there. Remember, they started Mike Miller, for goodness sake, in that game one against Chicago. This year, they're fully healthy. And so they're trying to, you know, make mountain out of a molehill, I guess, in this one, because the only thing similar is the amount of layoff. That's it. It's completely different otherwise.
Yeah, and this is one of those things where, looking at game one, and by the way, just to run it past you, we're going to talk to Rick Noland, Cavaliers beat writer at 3:35 for a preview of game one, and also to talk about all things NBA in the playoffs as, again, Spurs Thunder game two is tonight, Kush as well. So,
yep.
I mean, it's going to be kind of tough going back and forth there, or at least watching back-to-back games. I think there's going to be an overlap in there. I don't have the exact time.
No, the Cavs are at 8. The tip off for that one's at 8, and the Where's my calendar?
Here we are.
8 and 9, 7, I should say, yeah, and then 9:30. So yeah, NBA game about 2.5 hours. There might be an overlap if Cavs Hawks runs a little late.
No question about it. I expect that. So anyway, the point is, there's a lot of good NBA stuff to talk about with our friend Rick Nolan. Then that'll be at 3:35. Then we'll talk NFL draft with Chris Lemieux coming up at 4:05. And of course, there's a lot of baseball to talk about too, Jim. Another one yesterday. Talking about the Cleveland side of things, another one-run game, the sixth straight one-run game with the Indians, and five of them have been losses. They cannot win the close games, and thus they are finding themselves now two games under 500, six games behind the White Sox. Very, very different from the Tigers, who have surged and have won five in a row now and are just three games back of the Chicago White Sox in the American League Central. So there's a lot of baseball that we got to cover and talk about.
Absolutely, over the course of not just today, but the week. You got Tigers, who have been basically hot since the Indians swept them.
Yep.
And it's not just...
Six out of the last ten,
right,
and five in a row.
Right, and it's for the Indians, it's not just the losing in the one-run games. Their run totals are all down. I think yesterday was 2-1. And what have I at least been saying since the beginning of the season? It's all going to be predicated about how much they're able to hit. But at the same time, a bunch of these one-run games this past week for the Indians have been walk-off style, which is an interesting problem that I didn't think they would have, which means that's bullpen coughing up stuff.
Well, no doubt about it. Cody Allen is not himself. He is not having a good start to his season, no question about it.
I've always maintained that I hate putting closers in non-safe situations. For whatever reason, they're just awful in that. And I got to find some numbers on this to back this up again. I remember I did it a few years ago when the Indians still had Chris Perez at closer, and his ERAs were night and day in save situations versus non-save situations. So I'll have to look up some of those numbers again.
Closers
just
seem
to be different animals when it's not a save situation.
And you know what I say about that, though? I say to the closers, suck it up, Buttercup. I don't want to hear your freaking babyish.
You basically beat me to it. That's my response to it as well. But
I do. I hear that same story, and I've heard it too much. You know, the mentality isn't the same when it's a tie game and you come in and it's not a save situation. Then get your mentality right. Get your mental strength on. Do something to prep yourself. You can't tie your manager's hands so badly that he can't use you in the ninth inning of a tie game if
right.
he chooses to do so. You can't make him change the way he manages because, you know what, Skip, I just suck in these situations. Boy, I tell you what is the distance from rubber to plate longer in non-safe situations? Do they lower them or they raise the or lower the mound on you? Is the ball a little heavier? Do you not know where your strike zone is? Can you not throw a slider in it when it's a non-safe situation and suddenly it's magically there for you in a safe situation? No. Physically, it's all the same. Stop whining. Stop pouting, you big freaking bunch of babies. And that's all of them, whether it's Perez or anybody else who complains about non-save situations. This has been an ongoing sore subject with me in baseball for a long time. Tired of hearing it. Just freaking go out there and get your job done. All we need out of you, sir, is three outs. The same way we do as if this is a save situation. You need to get three batters. That's all. Not six. We don't need six outs now because it's a non-save situation, or even four. We just need three of them before somebody comes across and scores. That's all we want out of you. If you want to walk the bases loaded and then strike out the side, bang, 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 as long as nobody comes across, we don't care. Do your job. Shut up.
Yeah, I'm with you on there. It's just I've always found it interesting how there is, at least statistically, it does seem to be a different dynamic. And at the end of the day, I agree with your assessment. I mean, you're a major league pitcher. If you can't go out there and do your job regardless of the situation, then I don't know what to tell you, really.
Yeah, I mean, if we really want to go farther on this, and I don't know that I do, especially today since we're not going to do a ton of baseball today.
There'll be plenty of time for it later, I'm sure.
Yeah, because we're going to talk to Fennec later this week about the Tigers' run, and they are on a run, no doubt about it. Like I said, five in a row, and the Indians struggles, particularly in one-run games. They've lost three in a row and five out of six with one-run games. And we'll talk to Meisel about that and all of that stuff later this week. But just since we're there, I'll be honest with you. I will never understand the quote-unquote mentality that it takes to be a closer either. You know, I mean, the stuff about if you're a closer, you're worth, a good one, you're worth, you know, $16 million a year. If you're the setup guy, you're worth $9 million a year. If you work the seventh inning, well, you're really pretty much a minimum, a major league minimum player. You know, you're a bullpen guy in a non-save situation. When you come in, we don't expect very much, so you're a $4.5 million player. You know what? KMA. I need six outs out of you if you're a long reliever. I probably need you to go two innings. If you're a setup guy, I need three, the same as I need from the end guy, the back end of the bullpen guy. I need three. I don't care what inning it is. And the only thing that really matters about what inning it is, it matters inside your dome. It matters inside your thick skull as your little processor's in there going, man, if I get these next three outs, we win. And this is, it's nerve-wracking, but I can handle it because I'm a closer and my nerves are steel. You know, and what does the run that scores in the eighth against the setup guy count less than the one in the ninth? He needs three, too. His job just as important. Excuse me. His job, I told you I was getting upset here. His job is just as important to get those three before yours in the ninth. And you know what? His job is, his role is no less valuable than yours. I just get tired of this. Well, you know, he can't quite handle the pressure, the clumps of closing, so we'll make him the setup guy. You can either get three guys out, whether it's hitters 3, 4, and 5 in the middle of the order, or it's 6, 7, and 8, or 7, 8, and 9 at the bottom. I don't really care. You can either get three outs or you can't without letting a run score, and I just find the whole thing, you know, baseball players in general, to me, the mental nature of the game, to me, is so overplayed. It is so overplayed. You either have the physical skills to throw it 60 feet, 6 inches, and you have the ability to break it off, whether if you need to throw a curveball for a strike here, or you need somebody to chase a fastball out of the zone, you can hit your spots, you can locate, and get your three outs. The rest of it, to me, is just all talk. I'm tired of the mentally, he's stronger, and this guy's weak mentally, and he can't handle the pressure. You know what, man? You're on the mound against a major league lineup. I don't care if it's a sixth inning and the score is 9-1. It's pressure trying to get major league hitters out. And if you can do it when it's 1-1, you can do it when it's 9-1, and you can do it when it's 3-2 and you have the lead and you're trying to close it. I just find so much of it so weak. You know what? Sometimes the other guy just wins. Sometimes it's not because it was a safe situation or not a safe situation and my head wasn't there. Sometimes it's just you're throwing your best pitch and that dude crushed your best pitch because he's a pretty doggone good hitter too. I just find so much of the mental stuff, Jim, overwhelming and overstated and unnecessary. Just man up and play the game.
Well said. I couldn't say it, you know, any better.
Especially out of a reaction to that, by the way. I just, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I know I'm ranting and I'm monologuing and I'm soapboxing, and I'm not saying there's a response to it, but you know, if I can throw a dart on a deep out on a 25-yard out pattern to my receiver in the first quarter, and I got the same pattern called when it's the 2-minute drill and we're down by 6 points and we need a touchdown, and I can throw the same ball in the fourth quarter. It's a physical thing. It's, mm-hmm. If you have the ability, you have the ability. And if you're too mentally weak to make the same throw in the fourth that you made in the first, then you don't belong there. You don't belong in it. Don't tell me that suddenly the throw is harder because it's the fourth quarter. Don't tell me suddenly that hitter that wants to drive your best pitch 460 feet to straightaway dead center, embarrassing you, is less capable of doing it in the third than he is in the ninth. He's just as capable. You're just as capable. Stop making the mental excuse and just do your job. You know what I mean? It's just, yeah.
I know what you mean.
I know I'm ranting and I'm repeating, it just bugs me.
Here's the thing, and you're right in this rant, because it shouldn't be an issue yet. For many pitchers, it seems to come up, and the moral of the story from at least an Indians perspective is that it's costing him games late, which we didn't think would be as much of a problem. To go with the hitting that's not there, which we did at times expect to be a problem.
Yeah, they're going
to
be feast or famine.
Exactly, it all boils down to, here we are on May 2nd, once again, talking about an under 500 April. You can't keep having these starts.
Right.
You just
no
can't.
Doubt about it. No doubt about it. And that's exactly where they find themselves, and we'll see. By the way, if anybody wants to get on, and I should probably give the phone number. It is a call-in talk show, and you probably need the number. It's 866-240-1065 if you've got thoughts on that. I mean, you know, and this isn't a baseball-specific thing. That's why I brought up quarterbacks. You know, I'll go to the NBA. If it's 12-9 in the first quarter and you go to the line and you're comfortable getting, you know, shooting two free throws, dink, dink, now it's 12-11. That line, they don't move it back further when there's 2 seconds on the clock and you're down by two in the fourth quarter. They don't move the line back. They don't let somebody wave their arms in front of your face. The guys still have to stand outside the key waiting for the rebound. Nobody gets to go up behind you and whisper in your ear and say, miss it, miss it. It's the same free throw that it is in the fourth quarter as it is in the first quarter. I don't want to hear the pressure got to me. I don't want to hear, boy, it's tough for anybody to knock that down with that pressure. I just want somebody to go and do their job. You're physically capable. If you're not mentally capable, then you know what? You don't deserve the respect. It's just that simple. You know, Michigan fans will remember Ramil Robinson in 1989 had to knock those two down to win the national championship against Seton Hall. And, Kush, I know you probably don't remember that.
I do, actually, only because of recent clips and such of things like that.
There you go. There you go.
I don't remember it live. I wasn't young and then.
Glenn Rice, one of the best pure shooters the college game had ever seen, had carried them throughout the tournament. This is Steve Fisher, of course, coaching the team in that 1989 NCAA tournament, because Bill Frieder, who had coached them all season long, had taken the job with Arizona State, I guess it was. And he said, but I'll stick around and keep coaching through the tournament. He announced it at the end of the regular season. And then general manager, I just made it a professional franchise, then athletic director Bo Schembechler said, the hell you will. A Michigan man will coach the Michigan team. You're not a Michigan man anymore. You're an Arizona State man. And he named Steve Fisher to coach the team through the tournament. And you all know the story by now if you're a Michigan fan. Loy Vaught was the big post player inside. Terry Mills, I think. And Chris Mills. I'm trying to remember those guys. There was a bald power forward, I think, named Terry. And Chris Mills was a small forward. Ramil Robinson, Glenn Rice. What's that?
Chris Mills, future Cav at that point.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's right. So I'm trying to remember all the guys on that team. And they had a white shooter named Griffin, maybe, or something, just kind of a designated outside shooter, the 1989 Michigan roster. Anyway, Ramil Robinson against Seton Hall had to knock down two. Some people still call it a phantom foul. Some people still say it was a phantom foul. They said that Ramil got bailed out and Seton Hall got screwed, et cetera, et cetera. But all I know is the point is there was like 2.1 on the clock there. No, it wasn't even 2.1 because that was before the decimals. That was before the tenths of a second started to count. I think it was just like 2 seconds on the clock. And he had to step up in at both of them to win. And he did. Point being, that's what I would have expected him to do, not miss them because the pressure is on. It's the same shot. It's the same distance. And I just – kickers. Kickers. Just to go there. Blair Walsh. Remember the kid from the Vikings who ended the Vikings season with a missed 36-yard chippy or something like that?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, don't tell me that it was hard. You know – if you can make a 36-yard kick in the first quarter, make it with zeros on the clock. I just don't like this, you know, the mental. To me, you shouldn't be, and I don't want to overstate, but I know it's overstating and it's oversimplifying. You shouldn't be in that position if you're mentally weak. Most guys don't become championship-caliber athletes. And when I say championship-caliber, I mean Division I scholarship recipients, professional players. You don't get to that level unless you've got mental toughness. So don't use the mental, the pressure of the closed situation is what I need in order to rise up. And if I'm not in a closed situation, then my mind isn't quite ready to close. Don't let that be an excuse. Don't let that be the excuse why you missed the three to win the game, why you missed the free throws to win the game. If you didn't have mental toughness, you wouldn't have made it this far. You've got to be an elite world-class athlete with elite world-class mental toughness just to be here. Don't use it as an excuse. It's a cop-out when you fail. That's all I'm trying to say.
Well said.
Terry Mills. It was Terry Mills, by the way. Glenn Rice, Ramil Robinson, Loy Vaught, Terry Mills, Sean Higgins. Sean, not Chris Mills. I don't know where I got Chris Mills. That's the wrong name. That was wrong. Sean Higgins was the young, I think he was only like a sophomore, who played a huge role in that game as well. Michael Griffin was the shooter I was talking about. I'm looking at their lineup now from 88-89 with that Michigan championship team. Matt in Toledo wants to hit this Major League Baseball closer topic real quick, and then we got to get a timeout. But let's get Matt on the air. Hi, Matt. How are you, buddy?
Yes. Hello. Actually, the analogy that I have actually comes from football, and it's when you hear that, oh, he's not a third down back.
Yeah.
He's not a three down back. Well, okay, so you're never going to pass on first or second down because either A, he's not a good receiver, or B, he can't pass block. If you're a running back, you should be a running back all three downs.
Absolutely right. That is absolutely right. Now, I will say that there is a little bit of a different, well, I don't know. You can make the same argument about a certain defensive lineman. You know, he's not a third down player because he's not a good pass rusher, but he's a good run stuffer. So we'll play him on first down and second down, and then we'll bring in a different group of guys to rush the passer on third down. And like you're saying, well, what if they pass on first down? What are you going to do? Are you just a liability? Are we playing 10 against 11 now because you're not a good pass rusher on you're not a good pass rusher, and if they pass on first down, you're just going to stand there? I agree. Be the complete player or don't play the game. That's it's very well said.
Right. Can I ask you another question?
Yeah, why not? Go ahead. Where am I going?
Did you as a station decide not to broadcast Cincinnati Red games this year, or did they determine to drop you all as a radio affiliate?
No, it was the first. I'll at least say it was the first. Things change, you know, all the time in terms of, you know, some affiliations, and that was just one that we ended up going there.
Okay.
Yeah,
because
the way it works is affiliates pay essentially the
the
parent club. The affiliates pay the parent club or pay the club for the rights to carry their games, and then they sell the time and that sort of thing. And sometimes the fee structures change and business decisions are made. That's just strictly corner office guys. You know, the big money is in the corner office guys decide on what they're gonna carry and what they're not. And they decided no Reds.
Well, just some feedback. I'm not a Reds fan, but I enjoy listening to baseball on the radio. The Reds games last year, the year before on the radio, were much better than the stuff that's on the air right now in the evenings.
Okay, and you know what? I appreciate that feedback. We always welcome that, and we'll make sure that that kind of information does get to the right people in the right offices so that people know what the fans really think.
And thanks for the call and the input for that, Matt. The only thing I could say, you know, in response to all that is, you know, we do have the various ESPN games for Major League Baseball. Right now they're on Saturdays and Sundays. Eventually we're going to start getting some Wednesday games in and, all the playoffs. But, yes, in terms of a day-in, day-out affiliation, yeah, that changed, but we at least have the ESPN Major League various coverage. Let me see as I turn around and look. We got Dodgers Toronto on Saturday, a Boston Yankee thing coming up on Sunday, and then more and more down the line, and we'll have the All-Star and all the playoffs for you as well.
And dare I say, and I'm
so it's
speaking,
a trade-off. Sometimes you have the trade-offs like that.
Yeah, and I'm saying this strictly as a fan, not as a representative of the radio station. And like I said, I'm not a decision maker. But I can promise you this: if the Reds didn't suck so bad, their games might be more fun to listen to. And it might be something we'd want to bring back on. But they're in a bad way right now as they try to rebuild. I can tell you this. I didn't enjoy a whole – and I grew up as a Reds fan, by the way. This is not territorial or provincial by me saying this at all. I grew up a Reds fan, man. Big Red Machine. I was still a big Reds fan in 1990 when Eric Davis and the Nasty Boys won the World Championship, sweeping the A's with Rob Dibble and Norm Charlton and Randy Myers. I'm a Reds guy, you know, in the National League. Obviously, I'm an Indians guy in the American League. But it's not a whole lot of fun to listen to right now, I got to tell you.
And I'll say at least, but Bob, I have the same type of dynamic. You know, they didn't start interleague play till what, 98 or something, so I never had anything against the Reds. I used to hear stories of Pete Rose growing up from my uncle and my dad because that was that time period. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at the same time, you mentioned some of those teams around 1990. I actually lived for like a year and a half as a kid outside of Cincinnati, and one of the fun things the guys on our street always used to do was bug Chris Sabo when he was rookie of the year because he apparently lived down the street from us.
Wow, no kidding. How about that?
Yeah, that was a fun little time. And so, yeah, I have nothing against the Reds either.
Did he cork his bat when he was in the neighborhood games playing in the Sandlot too then?
No, he did not as far as I know.
He didn't have Super Balls? Do you remember when Super Balls came exploding out of his bat?
Oh, I do remember that.
Yeah,
wow.
We're way late because I got to get to our friend Rick Nolan and talk NBA playoffs here in just a moment. But that's fun stuff we're talking about right now. We'll continue that in a bit. But right now, SportsCenter timeout, Rick Nolan next right here on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5, The Ticket.
3:42 and onward we roll right here on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket. We are Toledo sports leader, and we cover all sports to the north of us, northwest of us, to the east of us, and that means Detroit and Cleveland. Cleveland is on the top of the list right now. Why? Game number one of the Eastern Conference semifinal series between the Cavaliers and the Hawks, ready to go tonight. And joining us for a preview of that and much more on the NBA is Rick Nolan, Cavaliers beat writer, who is not dodging orange barrels on his way to the palace, thankfully for him, before this one tonight. Hey, Rick, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well. I am actually about to pull into the arena parking lot as we speak. So.
Outstanding. And you know what? Even though you didn't have to hit the turnpike and head to Detroit for this one, you probably still had a number of orange barrels to deal with.
Yeah, it's amazing. I have no idea why I'm here 3.5 hours before the game starts, but leaving 45 minutes earlier than normal, I had virtually no traffic. So,
well, that's why. That's exactly why it's willing. It's worth doing.
I may just do it more often.
Yeah, and you're going to get a great parking space, no doubt about that, too. All right, Rick, let's get rolling here because, you know, it's weird. I said to Jim Cushman when we started this show 43 minutes ago, I said, you know, it's weird. The game one is tonight. I haven't even thought about the Cavaliers for a few days now. And I don't mean that in any disrespectful way or dismissive way or goofy way. What I mean is I've been watching, you know, game one of the Spurs and Thunder the other night, which was incredible, the blowout of the game sevens yesterday, the Warriors game one without Steph Curry, and I'm into all of these stories so much so that I forgot the Cavaliers. They've been off for so long. Today will be 8 days since they finished their sweep of the Pistons, and so many other things have happened in the NBA. I kind of forgot the Cavaliers were even out there anymore. It's strange.
Yeah, I unfortunately, unfortunately, haven't had that luxury. My well is dry on 7 days of Cavs stories without a game being played. So I'm extremely happy I have something specific to write about instead of having to manufacture something for another day, because I was running on empty.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, you know, I mean, you're trying to find ways to fill. You're going to practice every day. You're looking for sidebar stories, probably. Anything going on here? And any controversy? Because there's just nothing to report on. So let me ask you, obviously we know from a writer standpoint, that sucks. You got to find ways to fill the void. From a basketball standpoint, how do you think this impacts the guys? They were playing, obviously, extraordinarily well together for four games against the Pistons. Three pretty close games. One was more of a blowout, but they really had a good chemistry, a good flow going, and now you sit for 8 straight days without competitive basketball. How does this impact them going up against the Hawks tonight?
Yeah, we really won't know until 9:30 tonight. You know, we can go by what happened the previous two times they had long layoffs. They had had 8 days between games prior to the Chicago series last year, and they lost game one of that. And they had 9 days between games prior to the finals, and they lost game one of that. So hopefully they've learned something from that experience. And you really, if things don't go right, you can fall back on too much rest, but it could just be that they don't play well. You know, it's kind of one of those things that it's an intangible that you really can't pinpoint. But I have a bit of, quite honestly, a little of an uneasy feeling tonight, and that this could possibly be a game that Atlanta might steal. I wouldn't bet a dollar on it, but for whatever reason, I've started getting that feeling early afternoon today, and it hasn't left.
You know, Rick, looking at that, too, with the layoff and everything, and then Ryers and everybody trying to figure out something, yourself included, though you're not involved in this one anyway, but I've seen some stories pop up in the last couple days, and you mentioned game one of last year's semifinal after the layoff, and they're arguing, oh, well, you got to watch out for that again after the layoff. I don't think the layoff Still, to me anyway, the layoff had much to do with them losing game one against Chicago a year ago at this time. That was more of a, you know, they were still trying to get used to Love not being there. They started Mike Miller in that game, for goodness sake. Outside of the day layoff, which is about the same, 7 or 8 days in each case, outside of that, these are two completely different scenarios. And I think that's one instance where other writers, not yourself, are trying to find stories because it's been 8 days.
Yeah, I would agree almost 100% on that. I didn't want to write about it. I kind of felt forced to today simply because I ran out of ideas and angles. You know, this Hawks team, they like to claim that they're a better team than they were last year, but the facts of the matter are they won 60 games last year and had to get hot at the end to win 48 this year. They no longer have Damari Carroll. They haven't been quite the same team. When you look at this, you know, purely objectively, and you think back to just how badly the Cavs beat them last year without Kevin Love and with Kyrie only playing two games, it's really hard to come up. In fact, I did have to do five reasons why the Cavs will win and five reasons the Cavs will lose each series. I really, really, really struggled for five reasons why the Hawks could win this series, and some of them were really bad stretches just simply because I don't think there are five reasons why Atlanta can win four
times. I hate to torture you, man. We're talking to Rick Nolan, Cavaliers beat writer, talking NBA as Game 1 gets set tonight between the Cavs and the Hawks. Rick, I hate to do this to you, man, but read them to us. What did you come up with? Because I don't know how you did it. I can't think of five ways that the Hawks should win this series or would win this series. What'd you get?
I wish I could remember them all. The foremost one was that the Cavs resort to hero ball for most of the fourth quarter and play one on one. Another one was a really weak one. There's no pressure on Atlanta. They can play free and easy. And if this series somehow is tied 2-2, the pressure I think exponentially increases on the Cavs at that point. I think the last of my five, Bob, was something along the lines of, because anything can happen. That was the best I could come up with at five. And 1, 2, 3, and 4 weren't real strong either, no, quite honestly. But I was shy. I almost stopped and said there aren't five reasons.
Is this an assignment, Rick? Does your editor say, I want 5 and 5? Is that something you have to do for every series, or is this just something you've made a habit of doing?
It's something I've made a habit of doing. It's a way to expand the coverage going into these series. And, you know, the same way you do position-by-position matchups, which oftentimes aren't really worth the paper they're written on either. But people love them.
I do too, Rick. I do. And you do a great job of it, by the way. And as luck would have it, I have the sports page in front of me right now that you write for.
Tell me what the five are then.
So now, yeah, I was looking for it as you were talking because you said you didn't remember them. So I was just going to let you read them, but since you didn't, I'll just go ahead and share them here. The Hawks will beat the Cavs. Five reasons the Hawks will beat the Cavs. One, hero ball ensues, as you say. Isn't so much a reason why Atlanta would win as just a reason why the Cavs would lose if they resort to fourth quarter isolation basketball too early and too often with James or Irving dominating the ball while four teammates stand and watch. They could become much easier to defend and become stagnant. Get it? Two was teamwork. While the Hawks don't have superstar, well, how about this? I'll say the headline and you fill in what you meant by that. Teamwork.
Yeah, the teamwork is, you know, one of Atlanta's weaknesses is perceived to be that they don't have a legitimate superstar go-to guy in the fourth quarter of real close games, but they do have five quality players, and in theory, that could make them harder to defend down the stretch.
Okay, and that's fair enough. Well done. Number three, revenge. Cavaliers not only, and I'm not reading your piece yet, but the Cavaliers not only swept them last year. I heard this earlier today on ESPN. Kush, maybe you can verify it. I think it was during Mike and Mike, but their 8-0 record against the Hawks is the best of any team against any other team in NBA postseason history.
Don't know that for sure, but I know they have an 8-0 record against Atlanta in the playoffs, and they've won those games, I believe, by an average of 15 points.
So the revenge factor, is it just about because they got swept last year, or are we talking about the whole physicality and the Delly thing?
Yeah, the whole Delly thing with Kyle Korver and the tangle-up with Al Horford, you know, it's a motivational tool, possibly, but, you know, I think after the first 4 minutes, emotions pretty much run out of this thing and you have to perform on the court. So I didn't think that was a horrible number three, but they got weaker after that in a hurry.
No. but you know what? That's not bad, really, because I promise you that's what they're writing down in Atlanta. I guarantee you the writers down there for the Journal Constitution are saying something about, you know, now it's a, you know, payback time, time to make up for last year, or do this for Kyle or something like that.
Right.
You know, it's on their minds down there, it's fair enough for you to bring up here, particularly as we're looking for five and you're struggling.
Yeah.
Number four was no pressure, as you pointed out. They got nothing to lose. Right. They're free and easy. Cavaliers have all the pressure because they're expected to go back to the finals, blah, blah, blah. But number five, you might as well have just written, I got nothing.
That's what I did, basically. I couldn't even hide it. I had to point out that I had nothing after I wrote it.
Well, I just wish you would have written those words. You wrote, anything's possible. Sorry about this one, but it was difficult to come up with five legitimate reasons why the Hawks would win. One day, I just want to see your imprint in this newspaper. I want to see, I got nothing.
That may happen in the next round. Because, you know, it's already a given in my mind. I don't have to play, fortunately, that they're going to win this series. I can always resort to the "this is Cleveland" cop out as number five in a dire strait, but I figured I might save that one for down the road.
Well, there you go. And maybe as a means to that end, you know, number five, you know, Irving busts his kneecap again. Love gets his shoulder pulled out of its socket, and LeBron.
Exactly.
You know, blows his Achilles because it's Cleveland.
Exactly, and it still might go seven. But I don't know. I shouldn't sound so confident that they're going to win this series. But, you know, they beat them three times in the regular season as well. So it's just hard to see from a logical standpoint that Atlanta has enough talent to beat a clearly more talented team. You got to fill airtime with something, but it's really quite that simple. You could just say the Cavs are clearly better, and the better team almost always wins in a seven-game series. So
yeah, it's kind of like it's just a matter of how many it's going to take. Just like when we talked about with the Detroit series, you know, we kind of knew, and I think we all agreed it would go five, and it went four. And this one, I see your prediction. You do say five, and you think the most vulnerable game might not be the game three in the underdog city like we did in the Pistons series, but you think it might be game one because of this layoff?
Yeah, when I actually made that prediction, I was following the same theory as I did in the Pistons series, that I thought Atlanta would win game three, the first game back at home for them. It's only been today that I started feeling a little unsure of how the Cavs would perform tonight, and that could be just as much a product of, you know, you have to think about something, so it might as well be that.
Well, now that you have that thought, if you add today's thought to the in-print prediction, are we now talking six? Are we not talking about this? The Hawks could go up 2-1?
Possible, but I wouldn't be shocked if the Cavs did lose tonight if they come back and become all business and rattle off four straight after that. Okay. Nor would I be shocked if they just won four straight, period. Predictions are predictions, and you know, five sounded as good as anything, and if they win in four, they win in six. I don't necessarily consider that a wrong prediction on my scorecard. I just consider it not exactly right. So
I like how you do that. That's very well done. Rick Nolan is our guest, Cavaliers beat writer. Hey, real quick, Rick, just on a couple of the other storylines going on, your thoughts on Golden State, and you know, you could just say they are that good that without the MVP, Steph Curry, they still beat teams by 17 or 18 or whatever last night was. Or you could say they are in the best possible position, maybe of any defending champion without their star player, because they played what I see as a train wreck of a Houston Rockets team in that first round.
Right.
You know, they got this Portland team, which is, it's a great story, four new starters, they made the playoffs, but they're only here because Chris Paul and Blake Griffin got hurt and missed the last two games. I mean, it's just a couple of really overmatched opponents that Golden State is feasting on right now without Steph Curry.
Yeah, and I mean, they're a team that's almost fully relying on their two guards, and they're both a little bit undersized, and it's hard to win that way against the best teams in the league. I absolutely loved the way Golden State defended yesterday. They you know, you don't want to make the ludicrous argument that they're better without Steph, but they were a better defensive team because they put a lot of 6'7" defenders on guys who are 6'3" and 6'1", and almost funneled them into even bigger defenders and said, hey, either finish at the rim with multiple guys on you, or kick it out to guys who are subpar shooters. And I just thought it was a great game plan by Steve Kerr, a great execution by his team, which seems to be able to adapt to whatever it needs to adapt to. I'm a huge fan of the Warriors. I know that's almost sacrilegious to say in Northeast Ohio, but as a true basketball fan, I just love watching them play.
Well, I'll tell you what, I agree with you from that standpoint. From a basketball standpoint, I too am a fan of what they do and how they do it and how they've pretty much reinvented the game to fit all of their incredible myriad strengths. But I am not a fan of theirs because I don't like some of the guys. I don't like some of their attitudes. I think they're a little cockier than they should be, to be quite honest with you. But that's neither here nor there. I am extraordinarily impressed by everything you just said about them as a basketball team. Speaking of basketball, they don't play it much better than the Spurs played it on Saturday. Is that an indication of the gap between the Spurs and the Thunder, or is that just one of those outliers where they'll never shoot like that again, and there's no way that, you know, that a team like Oklahoma City is going to get blown out like that again?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine that San Antonio is going to play that phenomenally and Oklahoma City is going to play that poorly the rest of this series. It could be, you know, a revisit of the Boston Massacre from years past when the Celtics annihilated the Lakers.
Yeah.
But I don't see Oklahoma City winning this series. I think it'll be a much better series than game one indicated. I think it'll likely go six. But San Antonio was very, very good. And they're playoff tested and they have multiple ways to beat you.
And you know what it did?
LaMarcus Aldridge looked as good as he did all year in game one.
You're right about that. He was tremendous. And they were, I mean, what Aldridge had, what, 30, 37 or something? And
yeah.
Kawhi had 25. But the thing is, I mean, they shot 18 of 22 in the first quarter. That just can't happen. That's impossible.
Yeah. It's hard to shoot 18-22 when you're warming up before the game.
yes.
You know. And that could happen against, you know, on the floor in a conference semifinal series. Just truly a credit to them and how well they played. I actually flipped that game on at the end of the first quarter and it was basically already over. I could barely stay interested in it after that because it never got any closer.
Yeah, same thing.
It was a 30-some point
home.
Game at halftime.
I raced home. I was out with my family, and I said, hey, I want to be back by 8:30 because the first game of the Thunder and Spurs series is on, and I don't want to miss it because it's, you know, I mean, this is one of the series. I'm a big Thunder fan, and I'm a big Spurs fan. I love Kevin Durant, and I want to see him win because I think he's – I don't want to get into all that, but I really love Kevin Durant, and I like the Thunder, and I'm a huge, massive fan with such huge respect for Duncan and everything that Popovich has put
right
there. So I really wanted to see this, and my family's like, all right. So we get home on time, and, you know, half an hour in, which is, what, 20, 10, 11 minutes of the quarter, of the first quarter, maybe less than that. I'm like, okay, we can go back out if you want because I'm not going to watch the rest of this game.
Yeah, I was a casual observer for most of it myself. You know, it just – I could have never predicted that. And they had 6 days off, too, so – maybe my worries about the Cavs tonight are completely meaningless as well, but we'll see.
Well, hey, let me throw one more thing at you, and we'll let you go. And I know I'm late, and Jim Kushlin is probably really mad, aren't you, Kush?
Because a little bit.
I'm destroying the clock. It's already 4:00, and I'm going to ask one final question and wait for an answer on it. But I just have to. I read another article today. This is going back to the Cavs, just briefly to wrap this conversation up. Brian Windhorst wrote this for ESPN.com about LeBron James' jumper. And how he pretty much recognized in that Detroit series and understood and acknowledged that it isn't there, that it's broken, and it's not something he can rely on consistently. Despite, by the way, the last month of the regular season, it was the most consistent it had been all year.
Yes.
But in this series, Brian wrote, LeBron recognized that what Detroit was doing is laying back and saying, shoot it, I dare you, because we're not going to let you drive and kill us. We're going to let you throw that thing up from whatever angle you're throwing it up right now and take our chances. LeBron, recognizing that, did not shoot it as often, which is why he didn't even lead the team in scoring or shot attempts in the series for the first time since 2011 in the NBA Finals, when he deferred to Dwayne Wade to do everything. What do you make of that, I guess? Is LeBron James kind of accepting that this is a part of his game? If he continues to go to it and it isn't there, it's going to hurt his team, and he'd rather not shoot it at all than take bad shots he can't make?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Brian's theory. I have a little bit of disagreement with that he stopped shooting for the mere fact that he took 12 three-pointers in the last two games of that Detroit series. So that tells me he didn't stop shooting. Now, he only made two, so maybe he should stop shooting it. But he had some pretty bad field goal percentages the last two games of that series, if memory serves. I think it's a strategy that you're definitely going to see Atlanta employ. They're gonna, you know, they'd much rather have him shoot 18 to 20 footers than 6 footers or shots at the rim.
Right.
Not necessarily wide open ones, but semi-contested ones being the lesser of two evils. I think when LeBron takes a lot of his, perimeter shots, they come in a stretch, Bob, where he's gotten it going several times to the basket in a row and had individual success. And then it's kind of, okay, let's see if this is working as well. And if it is, he can be an absolute terror, as we saw towards the end of the regular season. When it's not, he can simply stop and, you know, just keep getting closer and closer to the basket and try to muscle all the way to the rim. And he still draws multiple defenders, and they got a lot of good shooters on this team, and he's a smart enough player to know that there are better shooters than him on it.
Right.
If he can get them shots, then he's ultimately helping them just as much, if not more, that way than if he shoots the ball.
And I think that was mostly the point of Wendy's column. It wasn't to criticize for the jumper not being there. It's to recognize, although your point about the last two games would certainly indicate otherwise. Here's the stat, and we're done here. As the regular season progressed, Wendy writes, he started abandoning his jumper. By the end of the season, 46% of his shots had come 3 feet or closer to the hoop, far and away a career high, and 13% higher than last season in terms of shots 3 feet close, 3 feet away or closer. So a guy who recognizes, I need to get inside to score. This is where I'm going to have to do my damage now. So,
real quickly, I can't criticize LeBron for that, because that's something most of us have been after him to do for his entire career. So,
that's right. And nobody can stop it. Nobody can really stop it. So
6'8", 250 and can jump out of the gym, go to the rim every time.
Rick Noland, a Cavaliers beat writer. Rick, enjoy the game tonight. Thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Anytime.
All right. You were way late. I apologize. We're out. Here's SportsCenter and more.
Very pleased with where we stand as a football team tonight, and we're excited to see these guys once they hit the field in May.
Adding a number of young, talented players that will be the foundation of what we're trying to build here, not only individually but collectively as a group. Even just having the guys from the first three rounds in has been special. You know, there's been an energy to it, headed in a positive direction after a long offseason, another difficult transition. You know, really a positive 3 days, a culmination of a lot of hard work. Volume of talent, but specifically addressing a particular areas of the roster where we wanted to improve. Wide receiver, obvious, and pass rusher as well.
And we have one mission, and it's to help the football team and organization become the best it could be. I think it's truly a credit to our scouts and our coaches, just our process, because I think we try to do everything we can to get as much information as we can to make good decisions about the players that we put on our football team. I think we get that it's bigger than just football. It's also about people and doing things right and doing things the way we want to do them here in Cleveland. And I think we set out and we were able to accomplish that.
Really well-rounded group, put a lot of time and energy into all of these guys. Really felt at the end of the day when we finished picking that we improved the football team, improved the depth of the team, and improved the competition of the team. And that was our goal going into it. When we do the evaluation process, it's important to not only look at the player and what position they play in college, have they played a position previously, you know, in their sophomore year, their freshman year, and when you're projecting to the NFL, can they play a different position? Because we know we can only dress, you know, 46 players. So every roster spot that we bring to the game is vitally important. If a guy can play more than one spot, that adds to his value. Yeah, I mean, I think I've said it before. I think it's good football business to take a quarterback probably every other year.
last year's was last year's situation. I don't think it has anything to do with this year. You know, we look forward, you know, to the matchup tonight. And, you know, we've been hungry for a game. You know, obviously, we've been off for quite a while, but we've been hungry for a game, and we're happy that we're able to have it on our home floor.
Main objective tonight is to get off to a good start. I mean, I think after having 7 or 8 days off, you know, that's something that we want to come out and do naturally. But need to get a good warm-up. Minds when they're in the right place, and we know that we're playing a good team, so that should get us up for tonight.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed, hour number two. We are well into it already because we ended hour number one by being in hour number two. Sorry about the run over there, but thanks so much for sticking with us and joining us once again right here for the second hour of the Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. Whether we're talking about stuff north of the state line or to the east of us a couple hours down the turnpike, we've got you covered on virtually every professional team you care about. Spent a good deal of time talking about the Cavaliers in the last segment because of the Cavaliers-Hawks series opener, game one of the second round series, otherwise known as a conference semifinal, is tonight. Now we want to talk a little bit about another team in Cleveland, the Browns, and, of course, the Detroit Lions, as we shift gears to the NFL. A little recap of NFL Draft 2016. You know, it's weird how fast it came and went. It felt like back when we were talking about possible draft picks in March, it felt like a lifetime away, April 28th, man. And now that it started on Thursday, it's like blink. And here we are. We're all set. Everybody is restocked with fresh young prospects, some good, some bad, and that's what Chris Lemieux is here to tell us all about, which ones are which. Chris writes, of course, for prideofdetroit.com, and you can check that out. That is an SB Nation website, and he joins us once again right here on the Extravaganza. What's going on, Chris?
Bob, it's good to hear from you again. Yeah, like the weekend kind of came and went in a flash, but we didn't get much sleep, so Sunday was kind of our recharge day. We're just... We're recovering here. My guys are coming back from Chicago. My other guy, my managing editor, is getting sleep, and I'm here, I guess.
And you're spending time talking to us about everything that happened over the weekend. All right. I want this to be kind of an all-encompassing look at the draft, Chris. But obviously, as you write for prideofdetroit.com, we can start with the Lions draft. And kind of, you know, it's weird. I was taking a look at your website today when Jim told me you were going to be able to join us. And it's funny because it certainly wasn't the first pick that the Lions made, so it's not the most important pick. And yet it's a point of focus, and that is the selection of Jake Rudock from the University of Michigan, you know, in this draft. You know, Bob Quinn, who was part of that montage that Jim just played, saying, you know, it's always a good idea to take a quarterback about every other year. Jim Caldwell, you know, certainly, you know, on board, I'm sure, with that as well. And here we are looking at a situation in which the Lions, who have a lot of needs, a lot of holes, quarterback is not one of them, but quarterback depth is always a concern in this league. With the rate at which quarterbacks get hurt, what was your thought about the Rudock pick?
Well, I mean, they let Kellen Moore go last year, so obviously they were only down to two quarterbacks. Mm-hmm. So it's really not that important, but nevertheless, the Maize and Blue people were out in force, and they've kind of been out in force. And I kind of wrote, I guess you're referring to the article I wrote today, which is the title was "Will Jake Rudock Be a Distraction for the Lions?"
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Well, I can tell you right now, just from looking from the Facebook comments, some people are either very mad that I didn't even ask that question, but then you look into the reasons why they're mad about asking that question, and once again, it falls along lines of, it's going to be interesting to see because, like, we've been doing this carousel for a while. The old adage is the most popular guy in town is the backup quarterback, and now you've got a local kid. You haven't had a local kid like this since, like, what, Drew Stanton? Even Kellen Moore was this bad. Like, you know, people, the thing of the winner guy. I have people coming in me talking about, you know, he really improved at Michigan, which, yeah, he did. I mean, he was getting kicked out of Iowa for basically he was losing that starting job in Iowa. I really don't know what to make of it. I think, though, Bob Quinn's analysis is a pretty good one, though. You know, take a quarterback every now and then, and we started to see some actual pretty decent quarterbacks going in the later rounds. I thought a lot of the early round quarterback selections were very odd, but I think there's definitely something to be said about late round value in the quarterbacks of this class here. You know, talked a lot about Kevin Hogan out of Stanford being one of those guys. I believe who did the Arkansas quarterback go to?
Brandon Allen, he went to the Jacksonville Jaguars, we need to talk about the Jacksonville Jaguars.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. Yeah. Universally being applauded for their draft. Some say had the very best offseason between free agent signings and this draft. A lot of people impressed with the Jaguars. We'll get to them, though, but continue.
Yeah. No, that's really about it. I mean, I'm at heart, I don't really care about it. What annoys me about Jake Rudock is literally just I have to look at comments and I have to listen to talk radio now and people calling in about Jake Rudock. And, you know, Matt Stafford's going to have one game and there's going to be some crank on like 97.1 up in Detroit calling in saying, look, you got to start Jake Rudock. The kid is a winner. Just give him a chance. Like everything we used to do with Kellen Moore, except now it's a Michigan kid. And,
that's the key here. That's the key here. Because the question is at what point will Matthew Stafford become Drew Bledsoe? Because this sixth-round pick from the University of Michigan, pick number 191. Sound very familiar? Pick sixth-round pick from the University of Michigan, number 199, turned into the greatest quarterback of all time. So clearly Jake Rudock is going to take Matthew Stafford's job after Stafford gets injured and go on to be a Hall of Famer, right?
I can't do it. I can't do it. Depending who you talk to, he's got a noodle arm, and depending who you talk to, the kid's accurate. But, I mean, he'll be a solid backup, but I don't, like, if he becomes something more, if he becomes that, if this becomes another Bledsoe Brady, I will consider that a coup and a miracle. But there's really no other way. You can't plan for a miracle like a lot of people seem to want.
Well, nobody planned for Brady's to be Brady. You know, that's the thing. Belichick gets called a genius because, you know, he picked Tom Brady when nobody else did. Yeah, well, he passed on him five times, too. So don't tell me he's a Brady. He's a genius who recognized Brady. But it's just, when you see it in print, sixth-round quarterback from Michigan taken in the 190s, you know, you can't help but say, ah, look at that. Okay, let's get more specific. I'm sorry?
No, I was just going to say real quick, I was actually more impressed with the Lions taking another late rounder, the sixth rounder. So Anthony Zettel, defensive end, played defensive tackle at Penn State. The kid's amazing. I wrote about him. He's like a very diverse guy. He's got short arms for the position, but he does like MMA and he did wrestling and baseball and used to quarterback. He's a really interesting guy. He got famous at ESPN because he tackled a tree in a woods coming back his senior year. I met him at the Big Ten Media Days. He's probably my favorite of these late round picks the Lions made.
When you say tackled a tree,
yes,
does that
a dead
mean
tree.
Like taking it to the ground?
Yes, he lined up. He went into his 3-point stance and just smacked into a tree standing there. And yes, took it out completely from by its trunks.
Lumberjack Anthony Zettel. How about that? That's a new way to do it. Top of the draft, just briefly, your thoughts on, you know, particularly Decker, obviously, they needed an offensive tackle. You and I talked about this and identified it as a big need before the draft. Defensive line went next with Robinson and obviously Glasgow. They needed a center too. So, you know, I don't know where these guys all fell on the best player available at the time we picked list. If that is indeed, you know, a Bob Quinn philosophy, but certainly they are need picks in terms of gaps on that roster.
They're meat and potatoes. Some people were thinking they might be served by taking a wide receiver, but it seemed like Bob Quinn's all about depth, and all he took was just really a lot of depth guys, a lot of guys just make sure that if someone gets injured, nothing's going to get blown up. And a lot of guys he took were just really big guys. We talked about this on the latest podcast we did. You know, Martin Mayhew would draft all these guys who were very good technically but might be a little undersized or not really fit right. Bob Quinn picked a lot of guys who were just really big and really nasty, like A'shaun Robinson and Miles Killebrew out of Southern Utah. He took physical specimens.
Yeah, and that is a good thing. Although I'm glad you pointed out the wide receivers too, because that was one of the things we all talked about again before the draft. Is at what point do they address the receiver position, as they don't have a replacement for? Not that you can replace Megatron, but you know, Marvin Jones being the free agent signing there and teaming with Golden Tate, that's certainly a position where they need, if not depth, they need, you know, possibly some star power,
right.
a one type receiver, not a 1A, 1B, or a second type of receiver in an offense, and they didn't address it at all in the draft.
Well, I think that's just going to weigh. I mean, I think that shows that he's happy with what they have right now this year. He might address it later down the line, or it might just be a philosophy thing, right? Like the Patriots don't really take a lot of skill guys like that. They tend to go out and get a lot of their skill guys either low low budget undrafted free agents or late rounds, or they just get them in free agency. So it might just be a matter of philosophy. You know, you draft for your line and you just sign your skill positions.
So let's switch gears for a moment again, because I want to talk about all things draft, but I'll just get your thoughts on this from Cleveland. They obviously had more picks than anybody else. They come away with, what, 14 picks in seven rounds?
14.
How many, 13?
14. Yeah. It was 14 after all the trades.
14
in seven rounds, which is amazing. And they still have a boatload for next year because of all of the trade backs that they did in the middle rounds. And they came away with a lot of guys. But is quantity better than quality? The question is how much are they really going to benefit from some of these, you know, late round receivers? They took what, five wide receivers overall of the 14 or six?
Yeah, like Jordan Payton from UCLA, Ricardo Lewis from Auburn, one of the guys who caught that amazing, the miracle of Jordan Hare, you know, the ball bounces up and he like goes into his arms against Georgia and they win that game. And that's the week before the kick six against Alabama.
Wow.
Like that was Ricardo Lewis. Rashard Higgins out of Colorado State. Who else we have? Jordan Payton from UCLA. Corey Coleman off the top. I mean, they're definitely going for some depth there. So they have that. Cody Kessler is interesting as far as a quarterback, but I think again, like if they're going to take a quarterback, they'll probably look for someone different next year. I like kind of what they were doing later near the end of the draft. I liked their pick of Spencer Drongo, offensive tackle guard out of Baylor, who is, again, physical specimen, beast. But then they also took their very last pick, 250, was Scooby Wright, linebacker out of Arizona. A little interesting because Scooby has a bit of a injury history, but I know some of my Lions guys were kind of worried that the Lions didn't take Scooby Wright. He definitely has talent. If he can get past an injury, he'll be great. And he was one of the, there were a few heartwarming stories from the draft, and Scooby was definitely one of them because there's a video of him, like, just hearing that he gets drafted last day, last round, and he just jumps full clothed into the pool behind his house.
That's another reason to love him beyond his name, because I love him just for the name.
No, but he was good at Arizona. If he can get back past his injury, he'll be great. And then speaking of another linebacker who was similarly injured and just had a touching moment was Jalen Smith out of Notre Dame, who got picked, you know, he's probably not going to play in 2016, but he got picked in the second round by the Cowboys. And there's just a great video of him just breaking down in emotion because, again, like, you know, early reports was there were fears that he may not be able to play football ever again. And who knows, maybe he can't. Maybe the Cowboys just took a gamble. But, you know, just for him to get picked by an NFL team is something really special.
Chris Lemieux joins us for some NFL draft coverage. Chris writes for PrideOfDetroit.com and SB Nation site. Jim Cushlin is here as well. We're just doing kind of all things draft. Talked about the Lions, talked about the Browns. Let's talk about some of the stories now. Connor Cook, as that thing played out, I mean, just really one of the most unbelievable things. Twitter, I don't know if you followed it on Twitter, but he was trending all throughout that second and third round on Friday, and his names like Cody Kessler came off the board. People were going ballistic and saying, who did Connor Cook murder? Who did he kill? What did he do that 32 GMs know about that is so bad that nobody else knows about, because nobody can make sense of this? Character issues, leadership issues. He wasn't a captain. Surely that can't take first-round talent and drive it all the way down to the fourth round or beyond. But I'll be dang, that's exactly what happened. What did you make of all that?
I was part of that joking. Tampa Bay, in one of the most bizarre picks I've seen in recent history, took Robert Aguayo, a kicker out of Florida State, in the second round. The second round. And I said, this is the date a kicker goes off the board before Connor Cook. Granted, I could probably say that about a lot of other picks, just because, again, they took him in the second round. But I just think Connor Cook slipped because he's just not that good. Like, to be honest, like, I know he's at the front of those Michigan State teams. He brought Michigan State a bunch of glory that it hasn't seen in years, in untold years. You know, he led that comeback in the Cotton Bowl a couple of years ago against Baylor. But he's fine. He's replacement level in the National Football League.
I don't think he'll ever be a starter, somebody's starter for 4, 5, 6, 7 years.
Well, here's the problem, too. He's also going to Oakland. He got picked up by Oakland, who right now, Derek Carr, I think Derek Carr is the future, barring some kind of problem. Like, if he somehow beats out Derek Carr for some reason,
no, that's not happening. No. I didn't mean that.
No.
Derek Carr is a franchise quarterback. They're very glad that they have him. Cook they got for depth, I have no doubt, or maybe they just have that whole best player available type of philosophy, and no matter what the position is, and so they took him. He's a chip. He's an asset.
I will say this. I think Cook's probably better than Christian Hackenberg, who the Jets took, who that's a disaster for them. Like, their three quarterbacks that they have on the roster now are Geno Smith, Christian Hackenberg, and I'm completely blanking on the third one here. Let me just pull it up. Bryce Petty, who hasn't played a down, and maybe their best chance is if they get lucky and re-sign Ryan Fitzpatrick. But Connor Cook, I mean, I just don't think he's ever going to be anything special in the NFL. If he is, then bravo for him.
So you don't think that it was anything to do with all of that, you know, the leadership thing? His teammates didn't like him very much. You're a three-year starter at the natural leadership position of quarterback, and yet you're never a captain. You don't think that had anything to do with it? You think it's just that talent evaluators looked at him and didn't see the talent, didn't see a very good player?
I think it played a small role when it comes from, like, where to put him in the pack of all these mid-round, late-round quarterbacks. But I think there was nothing in his play and nothing in his tape that really sets him a foot above that propels him into day one or day two, like he was supposed to go. I just think that's
why do you think
that's
though, that,
kind
why,
of what,
Chris, why do you think, though, and I'm not saying you're wrong, because we don't know. We don't know what every 32 GMs and player personnel directors and head coaches were thinking, you know, assuming that all coaches have some say when quarterbacks are picked. Like, I know Hugh Jackson had a big role in the selection from USC, but why did all of the draft gurus who are never, and I'm not saying we have to put stock in them, but sometimes they're wrong. Sometimes there are strong disagreements with coaches and player personnel guys and GMs. I remember that Mel Kiper blow up with what's his name from the Colts? For crying out loud, the former GM of the Colts.
Oh, no, I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
There was
their
a big blow up there.
Yeah.
Those happen occasionally, but generally speaking, the analysts, you know, the Kipers and McShays of the world and these types of folks are kind of in tune with what's going on. They all had him as the fourth quarterback going, without question, and probably at the very latest in the second round. You know, they had the two that went at the top, obviously, then Lynch, and they had Connor Cook, and it really wasn't close between him and, you know, Hackenberg or Cardale Jones or Cody Kessler or Dak Prescott or any of these other guys. It was Cook, and yet it's one of these rare times, is what you're saying, then, that the analysts were on a totally different page than the actual NFL talent evaluators.
Well, I think the problem is that a lot of the analysts were predicting a run on quarterbacks a lot faster than we thought would happen. We saw, you know, LA and Philadelphia trading up to 1 and 2 to get, you know, to get Jared Goff and to get Carson Wentz, two guys we weren't even on our lips that much before 2015 was completely in the books. And so I think they saw that and thought a lot of other teams would start panicking and, like, rushing up there, and thus the quarterback position would be overvalued for what this class is. Instead, what happens is you see San Francisco, who desperately needs a quarterback, they decided, no, we're going to take DeForest Buckner in the first round, and we'll wait until round 6 to get Jeff Driscoll. And then, you know, you saw Denver trade up to get Paxton Lynch, and I think Paxton Lynch is an interesting one because That's a pick that fits with Gary Kubiak's system. I don't think Paxton Lynch works in many other places, but he will work with Gary Kubiak because that's the kind of quarterback that Gary Kubiak likes, a guy like Paxton Lynch.
Word out of Dallas, Jerry Jones was just heartbroken that he couldn't get up and get back into the round to get to Paxton Lynch. He saw something in him that could be his guy of the future.
Well, if you watch any of Memphis football last year, he was very exciting to watch. Like, I could completely understand why Jerry Jones would be taken with that. And it's kind of also, you know, the future that the NFL is trying to get, the idea of, you know, a mobile quarterback, a guy who can run as well as throw the football really well. Paxton Lynch, you know, needs a little bit of work, but I think, you know, he'll have a chance to develop in Denver. I think it's a great landing place for him. But just when it came to Connor Cook, it's just a matter of he just wasn't good enough to escape a lot of those cracks, because once you get out of the first round, everyone else decided, all right, just calm down. We have other needs we need to fill. And then it's like we see in a lot of other drafts, just all the other quarterbacks get shoved down to like the end of day two or the beginning of day three.
Everybody who has analyzed the draft on national TV and national radio and on local radio like this has had a thought on Laremy Tunsil. What's yours?
We talked about him last week here, and I think he'll be fine for Miami. I think he'll be fine. He'll be a starting tackle for them. I'm just still floored on what happened. Like, that is probably the weirdest episode in the draft I've seen in a long time. Just this idea of someone just trying to deliberately, and I think there's been more news out that it was probably not his stepfather. It was someone who just was able to hack in there and just found some juicy stuff to throw out there. I really don't know what to make of what happened still. Like, I'm still talking with my college guys. I'm still trying to figure out what's going to happen to Ole Miss too. Like, this whole episode was just bizarre, and I think it kind of overshadowed what Tunsil was going to Miami. Like, I know he's been avoiding the press.
How much money do you think that cost him, though, going 13th overall? At one point, as multiple sites and broadcast outlets have said, at one point he was considered maybe the best offensive player in the draft. And obviously that's tough to do when you have Ezekiel Elliott there and quarterbacks to say a tackle. But better at what he does than everybody else is at what they do. And he ends up going 13th after the slide. At least one club went public and stated, we passed on him because of the video. The video of him smoking the weed through the gas mask and that whole thing, and that's a character thing they did not want to deal with. Maybe they feared they were going to get another Josh Gordon type of thing where you never know if you can rely on him or if he's going to end up being suspended, being in the drug program that the league has, the protocol. And that was the Ravens. The Ravens confirmed. They passed on him because of that. And I'm sure there are others who won't admit it publicly that that was the case. I mean, he may literally have cost himself by smoking weed and then somebody putting the video of him doing that online. He may have cost himself $10-12 million in signing bonus money.
Well, not as much as that. I'm looking at SpotTrack right now, which is where we tend to go to do a lot of our free agent stuff. Just projecting out real quick, they're looking at Ronnie Stanley and projecting his total value estimated at $20 million. With a $13 million signing bonus.
What does that mean for the first year?
Over
his career.
They don't have the explainer. I'm assuming that's kind of like the. I'm assuming that's going to be kind of like an average value when it comes to their rookie contract. I'm looking at the 2016 cap room is only going to be like $3.7 million. I'm looking at mostly the signing bonus, $13 million there.
Okay.
Looking down, then going down to 13, Laremy Tunsil. Total value estimated is going to be $12.5 million, $7.26 million signing bonus. So at the very least, just in signing bonus, it's about a $6 million hit. It's almost half the signing bonus he would have had if he went to Baltimore.
And Baltimore picked where?
Six, and they took Ronnie Stanley.
Okay. Again, and this is just all hypothetical because it depends on the needs of the teams at the top. We know the quarterbacks were going to go 1 and 2, which they did. But again, going back to the pre-video rankings and the pre-controversy rankings over Laremy Tunsil, he was, again, considered to be maybe the best offensive player. He could have gone as high as 3. He could have gone at 4. It just depends on who's up there and who wanted that. If you go from that to where he ended up being picked at 13, that difference, that gap grows quite a bit.
Yeah, there were two tackles taken before Tunsil, too. Stanley went to 6, and then 8, Tennessee took Jack Conklin. And everyone who I talked to was saying that San Diego was going to take Laremy Tunsil before this happened. Then they go Joey Bosa, which seems odd. But,
yeah.
I mean, San Diego probably had one of the better drafts,
too. There has to be a reason.
Too.
They may not want to say it, but again, it may have been part of the reason. And maybe not just the video of the shock of the video, but just the, hey, maybe we don't know as much as we need to know to invest this high of a pick and that amount of money, which goes according to the slotting system, to this guy. What if he can't be here? What if he is going to be one of these ongoing problems here? So
yeah,
I know the Ravens aren't the only team that had that thought.
I mean, and as he fell, too, it kind of became a game of chicken, too, right? Like, it's just kind of like, it's kind of like what happened with Miles Jack, too. Miles Jack slipped all the way to the second day. Everyone thought he'd be a first-day draft pick. But because he accidentally comes out and says, I might need microfracture surgery soon, which, by the way, isn't apparently going to happen. James Andrews chimed in after day one, said, no, there's no short-term need for microfracture surgery. And he gets picked up on the second day, but in both cases, it becomes a game of chicken where it's like there's a risk associated with this guy, either real or supposed, and we're going to – it's just basically, hey, who wants to be the guy who has done the cost-benefit analysis to taking this risk?
Right.
Who is going to be the team to do that? And in the case of Laramie Tunsil, it was Miami. And in the case of Miles Jack, it was Jacksonville in the second round.
Last two things to discuss here. Chris Lemieux, SB Nation's Pride of Detroit.com, joining us, Bob France and Jim Cushlin as well. Last thing to discuss, and it'll both of them will surround the Jaguars, and that is the Miles Jack pick and then the Jaguars draft, because a lot of people feel like they got the two best defensive players in the draft in Jalen Ramsey and in Jack. Get your thoughts on that. But regarding Jack in particular, what does it say about the character of this guy that he came out and said, I might need this? I might need microfracture surgery. I want everybody to know what they're getting when they get me. I'm sure I'll be fine, but this is going on. It's one of the most amazing things that I've ever heard, unless I didn't hear it correctly, and he didn't really announce it. It slipped out and leaked out, and he had to acknowledge it and own it. But this is a guy who's playing for money, and he's about to be drafted in the first round, probably, as you say, on the first day. And you know, he says, I might need surgery. And whoever takes him, if he is healthy, is going to get a great, great defensive player, but might get damaged goods, and he's willing to say that out loud. What is your thought on all that?
Yeah, and especially in the NFL, too, where it's a lot harder to come back from microfracture surgery. I know in the NBA, guys like Amari Stoudemire, they've had microfracture surgery, but that's not the same as trying to come back from that in the NFL. Usually what happens is a lot of established starters in the NFL, if they need microfracture surgery, unless you are an established starter in the NFL, you would take microfracture surgery, you're probably not getting a starting role. So that was kind of brave of him. Again, keeping with the Laramie Tunsil comparisons, Laramie Tunsil was also praised for his maturity, kind of owning up to a lot of what happened with the video afterwards as well. But Miles Jack, yeah, I don't know if it was a slip. I haven't heard the audio yet. I've just read what he said. So, and I mean, you know, that happens sometimes. These guys are just honest, and you know, it's a big time in their lives. Maybe he didn't mean it to slip out, but if he just said it out there, then
I haven't heard audio either, to be honest with you, Chris. As I understand it, he said it to a newspaper, so I don't know if there is audio, right, or if it's just the New York Post quoting it. The New York Post is the place where I first heard about it, and the quote is, the degenerative problems are there, but it's nothing extreme. Down the line, I possibly could have microfracture surgery, potentially. Who knows what will happen? Nobody knows how long anybody's going to play in this league. To play 3 years in this league would be above average, end quote. So that's what they quoted him as saying. And again, it's reported as, you know, Jack admits he might need surgery. And again, if he's saying that publicly, knowing that guys or teams and GMs are going to make their decisions in part on his health, I find it either astoundingly naive because he's putting millions at risk with that, or incredibly bold and a huge, you know, statement about his character that he's willing to tell the truth about his health.
I think it can be a bit of both. I think he didn't realize the impact of what exactly microfracture is when it comes to the NFL, not realizing that microfracture is kind of been this really big thing. It used to be what Tommy John used to be in baseball before Tommy John got advanced enough to really, you know, guys would come back from Tommy John and just kind of still dominate. Tommy John used to be, you take Tommy John, you're not coming back as a dominant pitcher. So I think it's a little bit of ignorance on his part, but at the same time too, yeah, I think he realizes that it's probably better for him just to be forthright about it, because if he doesn't say it, then I think he kind of knew, like, maybe someone else would probably leak it out at some point. Nothing stays secret in this league. It's kind of weird like that.
No, that's very true, and that's why I wondered if it had been leaked already or if it may be leaked soon, and that's why he wanted to get out in front of it to tell people. I don't know. I'm going to play this blind because I found a clip from Miles Jack talking about this. I don't think this is it because, again, it's my understanding that this was an interview with a newspaper. This is actually an interview with CBS. I want to just play this minute clip and see exactly what he says. If I can, and give me a second here.
Obviously, we're human. When I know something's right, that's like me saying your finger's falling off your hand right now. You know your finger's attached to your body. You know what I mean? Everything's fine, but it definitely adds that motivation that, like, okay, when I get to show people that I'm fine and everything, I want those people to eat their words. You know what I mean? And they will, but just got to get through Thursday, and then when I put that helmet on for rookie minicamps in like a week or whatever, I'll be y'all see me out there running around and playing football again.
Have you been able to enjoy what it means to come here?
Okay, that obviously was just a short interview with CBS Sports, and that's fine. And it was pre-draft, obviously, because he talked about Thursday. So he wasn't acknowledging, at least in that particular clip, about the injury. But I just thought it was a fascinating story. And now, Chris, the whole thing about Jacksonville, they get Ramsey, they get Miles Jack, and they have added, potentially, taking a look at their free agency haul and as active as they were, they may have added in free agency in this year's draft as many as 8 new out of 22 starters for that football team.
Well, not only that, but just look at the rest of their draft, too. Third round, Yannick Akume out of Maryland for depth, Sheldon Day from Notre Dame from depth. They probably one of the better late-round quarterbacks with Brandon Allen, Jonathan Woodard, defensive end from Central Arkansas. Like, they finally invested in their defense. For so many years, you know, investing in their offense, they've got a great offense now. They have Blake Bortles, and they have Allen Robinson, and they have Allen Hurns, and T.J. Yeldon looks fine for them now. And yeah, all of a sudden they've been starting to invest heavily in that defense. And I keep saying this to people, like, you keep looking at the AFC South. You cannot tell me that's a good division. The Colts have been winning that division nonstop. And even back when it was Peyton Manning, it was just Peyton Manning. Like, he had like a couple of good wide receiver now and then. But, like, the Colts have done nothing to really win that division. And we saw it last year, too, when they didn't win the division because Luck was out. The Texans win it, and the Texans, like, you know, squirm into the playoffs because they're the best dumb man in that division. And they just get completely demolished by Kansas City. Like, that division is up there for the taking. It is ripe, and they have a quarterback, and now they're investing in the defense. And, yeah, to get a guy like Jalen Ramsey, who I will swear up and down is probably the best pure football player in this draft. Not position player, football player. He is a big, mean guy, and he's going to be in that backfield now on the defense. And then again, Miles Jack, you'll have to roll the dice on that. And then Jacksonville and I think the San Diego Chargers, I feel, and probably the Vikings, those are like the top three draft classes of this draft. It's the Jaguars, the Chargers, and the Vikings in any order. Because I think the Vikings got some pretty good picks. They got Moritz Behringer out of Germany, who is going to be interesting to see. They got some Mackenzie Alexander, some interesting pieces. And then the Chargers did a really good job as well. But, yeah, Jacksonville. Everyone's talking about Jacksonville today, which is it's fascinating. But I think it's also warranted because, again, they have a good quarterback with Blake Bortles. They have a good offense. The only thing that's held them back is a defense, which seems weird because their coach.
And they addressed the daylights out of it, no question about it. Hey, Chris, we got to run. Just real quick, though, from you and Jim Cushlin. At the top of the draft, two quarterbacks that I kind of don't believe are franchise guys. I think if they came out last year, they're the third and fourth quarterbacks taken after Winston and Mariota. And a couple of years before that, I think they're further down. So it's just they were the best of this group. So here's my question to you both, just briefly. Jared Goff, over and under on number of Pro Bowls made in his career by the time it's done? 3. Over or under, Chris?
Under, but it's going to get pretty close to that. He'll be good for them. Be good for them. Not great, but good.
I'm going to go under as well right now.
Carson Wentz, 2.
Under. I like Goff a lot more than Wentz. I think the Wentz thing is just kind of weird.
Jim? I'm going to say under right now, but I'm of the opposite opinion of Chris. I like Wentz better than Goff. That I was actually hoping, had the trades not happened, that the Browns would have picked him at 2.
Interesting. Very interesting. But the point being here, look how much those two teams gave up to get up into the position, the Rams and the Eagles, to get two guys that we all agree will be under 2 or 3 Pro Bowls in their career, which means they are not going to be quote-unquote franchise quarterbacks, despite the boatload of picks they give up to get, quote, franchise quarterbacks. And that's where we'll leave it. Chris Lemieux, PrideOfDetroit.com. Check it out online. It's a part of SB Nation. Chris, thank you.
Have a good one.
You got it. All right, here's what we're going to do. We need a timeout. Last one of the program, and while we do this timeout, how about we do something awesome for you? I got a nice prize for you, a pair of tickets. If you would like to see the Toledo Symphony Orchestra performing the music of the Stones. That's right. The orchestra does the Rolling Stones at Stranahan May 21st. That's 19 days from right now. If you're the 10th caller to 866-240-1065, we will hook you up with those tickets. Good luck to you from the ticket.
106.5 The Ticket right now traffic, driven by superfitnesstoledo.com. Celebrating 44 years, servicing Toledo for less than $5 per week average cost.
We have one accident reported in Point Place, Ottawa River Road at Souter. That's right now traffic.
Dear Safe Auto, my ex-boyfriend Dave recently got car insurance from you, and it also looks like he finally got a haircut, got a new dog, and got a new girlfriend. And no, I'm not stalking him. I dated him for a year, and he couldn't drive his car, but now he can, and he looks really happy. And that makes me sad. Thanks a lot, Safe Auto.
The right insurance for the right price from Safe Auto makes most people happy. Get your free quote today at safeauto.com and enjoy the road ahead.
Make your mom happy this Mother's Day with flowers from Bart's Viviano. Send mom a beautiful fresh flower bouquet or outdoor blooming plants that she can enjoy all summer long. Call or stop in either of their convenient locations or shop online at bartsviviano.com.
With OnStar, you don't need to drive the newest model car to have the latest in connectivity. If you're not connected, now get select OnStar services free for 3 years with no strings attached. You'll get a mobile app that lets you start your car or unlock your doors from your phone and monthly diagnostic email reports. Just push the blue OnStar button and ask for 3 years of free mobile app and diagnostic services. Emergency and security services are not included. Eligible on select 2011 and newer vehicles. Visit OnStar.com for details, coverage map, and system limitations.
Napa Know How!
Some people steer clear of store brands, but Napa Conventional Motor Oil for $2.19 a quart is more than a store brand. It has the Napa logo on it, a logo that represents quality and knowledge, the same logo on the store and that guy's shirt. So pick up Napa Conventional Motor Oil for $2.19 a quart, only available at, you guessed it, Napa. That's Napa Know How.
General States pricing. Sales prices do not include applicable state, local taxes, or recycling fees. Offer expires 5/31/16.
ESPN Radio in Toledo, powered by Pizza Hut.
With Pizza Hut's $5 flavor menu, you can say yes to any two or more of your favorites for just $5 each. That's yes to medium one-topping pizzas, Wing Street wings, and new stuffed garlic knots. It feels good to say yes to the $5 flavor menu, only at Pizza Hut.
Limited time offer. Additional charge for extra cheese toppings and pan crust.
A quick check of your weather from Bell Tire Weather Center. Bell Tire, where you always get the lowest tire price, period. Overcast skies, slight chance of a rain shower, high of 54 for the remainder of your Monday, down to 42 under partly cloudy skies tonight. On your Tuesday, partly cloudy, 64. And on Wednesday, light rain with some thunderstorms by evening, high of 55.
Toledo's sports leader, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
52 degrees at 4:50. I'm Jim Cushing with your local Sports Center update. After an eight-day layoff, the Cleveland Cavaliers finally back on the court. Game one of their second-round series. They're at the queue to take on the Atlanta Hawks. It all gets underway with a 7 o'clock tip. Most teams in the area, baseball-wise, are on off day today, but not the Toledo Mud Hens. Middle game of their six-game road trip as they're in Gwinnett to start a series tonight. 7 o'clock, the first pitch time there. Some notes for the Cleveland Indians, though. Roberto Perez, he is now DL-bound with a broken thumb. Veteran catcher Adam Moore has been called up in his place. Lions news, Ziggy Ansah's option has been picked up just in time for the deadline, which hit about 50 minutes ago to pick up options. He'll now be a Lion at least through 2017. Finally, there are five Bowling Green Falcons who were signed as undrafted free agents. Highlighted by Matt Johnson goes the Bengals. Roger Lewis to the Giants, and Travis Green to Washington.
Friends don't let friends buy ugly diamonds. That's why I send all my friends to the castle.
Unfortunately, average diamonds found in most stores are pretty poorly cut. I'm David Fairclough, inviting you to David Fairclough Fine Jewelers, where I personally hand-select every diamond for maximum brilliance, fire, and lasting value, directly from the world's finest diamond cutters.
Come get hands-on with real loose diamonds before you buy, like the amazing Heartstar, the most perfectly cut diamond your money can buy.
You can't buy a better quality diamond at a lower price anywhere in Ohio. That's the David Fairclough money-back guarantee.
We are Toledo's diamond engagement and wedding ring store.
So before you spend $1 at one of those big chain jewelry stores, ask a friend who knows diamonds and he'll tell you
he came to the castle.
At David Fairclough, we can make diamonds a part of your life.
David Fairclough on Central Avenue, 1 mile west of Interstates 23 and 475.
Your Toledo home for the NBA. We are ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Once again, it's the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed it is. Good conversation there with Chris Lemieux on the NFL draft. A little recap of what the Lions did, what the Browns did, and a little bit about what the Jaguars did, among other teams. You know, it's really amazing, Jim. I'm looking around at all of these draft grades that I tell you I abhor, and I do. I don't like them because it's just impossible. It's a way for quote-unquote draft gurus to justify their contracts, to tell fans eager to know whether or not their team just got better, especially teams at the top of the draft whose fans are the most frustrated because they suck for the most part. You know, you're drafting at the top because you were 2-14 last year. Excuse me. And then everybody wants to know, no matter where your team drafted, you know, did we just get better? Are we a contender
now?
Did we get the game breaker we needed, or did we get that tackle we needed, or whatever? And so to justify their status as draft experts, excuse me again, I'm having a coughing fit over here, and I'm trying not to stop the show. But to justify it, they give these grades way too early, and we don't know if Carson Wentz can play. How can somebody give the Philadelphia Eagles a draft grade for giving up all of those picks, number 8 overall to the Browns, number 77 overall, a fourth-round pick, number 100 overall? That's, of course, what the Browns used to parlay into another pick after that. But then, of course, the Eagles give up their first-round pick next year and their second-round pick in 2018. How can any guru know whether or not this was a good trade until they see Carson Wentz play? And not just for a year, but for a couple. So I don't like all of those things.
No, and I'm with you. You know, it's because they have to put out something. Part of us is guilty of that, too, because we end up clicking on those as well. I know I do, even though I treat them all those little grades with a grain of salt for the same reason you do. And by the way, I'll do a flip side argument on these grade kind of things, too, in the sense, you know, you're talking about Carson Wentz and you don't really know. Flip side of it. Most everyone's given the Browns horrible grades for the USC quarterback, the Kessler pick in the fourth round. And there's two things that I've been just dying to get off my chest about this one. Number one, because I've heard and seen the panic in the Cleveland area based on like, oh, what are you doing with Connor Cook and others like that still out there? I mean, is he really going to be your starter? No, I don't think he will ever be the Browns starter. I really don't. And at the same time, why was it him over Connor Cook? This is something that I think all Browns fans going forward with this current regime need to keep in mind, and that's the analytics angle. And I have to still dig up more information on this one, and I'm going to. I just haven't found the right one yet, but I tweeted out right after they picked him. Man, that smells like an analytics pick to me.
I heard two things about that. One is that theory. The other is Hughes' ties to Southern Cal.
Yes, that's the other one, yep.
He's got ties to Southern Cal, and this was a favor kind of a pick more than anything else. I find it hard to buy that one only because you're talking about a guy in his first year of his second head coaching gig and maybe his last one if it doesn't go well.
Sure.
Are you really going to give, you know, do a favor for somebody at the risk of your own job by making a bad pick in which you could have added another piece to your puzzle to put your roster together? So I don't know if what I believe in that. But as far as the grades go, and that's actually, I'm glad it's interesting you brought that up because that's where I was headed with that little mini monologue there. While I don't like the grading thing that people do, and it's just justification for, you know, I'm an expert and because people need to hear that their team did well or whatever the case might be.
Right.
I am amazed that in this 14-player draft that the Browns had, which is the most, by the way, since 1979, that any team has come away with in one draft class. And in 1979,
there were like 13 rounds or whatever, right?
I think it was 12.
Or 12.
Yeah. So, at any rate, most picks since 1979, and most of the grades I'm seeing from these quote-unquote so-called experts, Jim, are in the C to C-minus range. Nobody's given them an F, as I can see. Nobody's given them an A either. Because what they did is they got a whole bunch of players to fill spots on the worst roster in the NFL. So they needed to do that because it's a terrible roster, but most of them are just players. They traded back so many times, they may have given up all of the playmakers just to get more players who don't necessarily make plays. And that's really a fascinating look at this as you know, time goes on,
yeah,
and you really start to evaluate.
No, and that's true. And my last point is I'm just, you know, throwing it out there to Browns fans, especially when they're thinking about Kessler or five wide receivers or even Coleman at the top. Just remember, always keep the analytics thing in the back of your head when dealing with this current regime in the Browns.
Yeah, and they went out of their way, by the way, in post-draft interviews, they went out of their way to say, Sasha Brown said, you know, people want to say that, but we just scouted him like everybody else scouts him. You know, analytics is part of what we do, but it doesn't impact who we pick as far as players. He tried to say that's not the case, which means it probably is the case. So, all right, that's it. I have more, but I don't have time to say it. We'll do it tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Mike Miller next with Drive Time. Stay right here on The Ticket.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.